This week on Art in the Air features traditional photographer Tim Lace and fresco artist Diane Grams discussing their Chesterton Art Center exhibit Gods and Warriors in September. Next, artist Michael McChane, who creates stunning scratchboard portraits currently on exhibit at Bronzeville's Gallery Gachard. Our spotlights on Art Barn's School of Art's 8th Annual Art Blitz on Saturday, September 21st.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry, Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther, Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And I'd like to welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Art Barn School for Art, Amy Navradakis, who's the executive director there. And she's going to talk about the event coming up called the 7th Annual Art Blitz. It's on September 16th. It'll be running 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And, of course, that's always located 695 North 400 East in Valparaiso. Amy, welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thank you so very much. Hi, Esther. Hi, Larry. How are you?
Glad to have you back. Well, it's an exciting time again. You're coming up, and it's kind of something that people look forward to. I guess it's not technically fall at that point, but as we're getting into fall. So tell us about what's different this year about Art Blitz and what people can expect.
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of things that are very similar, but there will probably be a few new art projects, and we have a new food vendor this year, and some of our stage acts are going to be different. So we're pretty excited. I think that...
Yeah, live demos and art making and hands-on
art activities. Yeah, so like we are going to have demos by some of our ceramic art instructors. So they're going to kind of show off kind of how things are done in the ceramic studio. But one of the new things that we have for people to do that relate to the ceramic studio, just because clay is a little difficult because there's a process involved and some of it takes time. If you do it all on the same day, there's no time for the clay to like dry and get it glazed and go through the kiln and all that, right? So we have some pots that have already been bisque fired, and we're offering people an opportunity to either paint those pots or to put some glaze on them. And then we'll fire them after the festival and they'll have to come back and pick them up. But that's sort of a new thing that we're doing. So we're doing a lot of demonstrations, and then there's the art activities.
And music this year?
The music this year, let's see, we have someone named Norman Basile who's going to come and perform. The Hoosier Recruits are returning. They're an 8-piece band, and they support the Old Time Dance organization in the area, and they're a lot of fun, and they perform, and people are encouraged to get up and dance and be a part of it. Eric Lambert and Char are going to be here. So we're excited. They're really great. They do a lot of really wonderful covers, and they're very friendly and just beautiful, wonderful people. Robert Barthel is going to play, as well as Tim Rounds. So I think that's going to be our lineup.
Ooh, wow. Yeah. What about food?
food, we have Butter and Grace. So they have been to quite a few festivals. It's a food truck, and they have all kinds of delicious opportunities. I think they're kind of known for their fried pickles, but they're going to have a lot of different options, everything from, you know, like a meal that you can order to desserts. But they do a really nice job.
Yeah, one of the things that's famous there is chair painting. Are you still going to have chair painting going on?
Yes, of course we're going to have chair painting. The chair painting is really a lot of fun. So, you know, people can either collaborate on a chair that's being painted on that day along with other people, or if you want to take a chair home, we do charge a little higher, you know, activity ticket price for that. But you can, you know, work on the chair, and if you don't finish it, you know, at the festival, you can always finish it up at home. But we have got a lot of little chairs for first come, first serve if people want them.
And, of course, you have your resident wildlife there that people can always take a look at.
Yes, we do. We have actually, we are planning to have unicorn sightings again this year. So I think we've got three sightings planned if we can wrangle our unicorn and get her ready for everybody. But that's always a huge
hit. If she wants to cooperate.
Yes. But she's you know, very patient with us, and you know, but she's
like, oh no, that time of year again.
yes. But our unicorn is very popular among the younger set, so that's a lot of fun.
And of course, you have stuff for all ages, like face painting and things like that. Mm-hmm. But you also have some themes. Well, of course, the sunflowers will be in bloom, I think, by then.
They should be. That's the plan.
Knock wood, you know, and everything. But you also have some things that are related to, like, wildlife art projects and something with the Shirley Hines Land Trust that you're doing.
Yeah. So that's great. I'm glad you mentioned our partners. So Shirley Hines Land Trust is one of our partners during the year. And we invite them out to have a booth. And, you know, they also, you know, they work with us on guided hikes or, you know, helping people to sort of identify plants in our gardens and that kind of thing. So they're sort of on site to kind of talk a little bit about their mission too, but how our, you know, how things sort of, you know, cross relate. We also are having Humane Indiana coming as well, and assuming they've got animal ambassadors that are ready, that we'll have some ambassadors on site as well. Aww. So that's always exciting.
Well, we're in our last minute here. I noticed that you're doing only one day this year as opposed to 2 days. That way you can pack more stuff in. Is that a decision? And then tell us a little bit about dates, times, how people can find you.
Yes. So, we are just one day. People can find us at artbarnschool.org. And if you have any questions or anything like that, you can always call us at 219-462-9009. But yeah, it's going to be a fantastic day. It's free to get in, free to park. And, you know, we really hope that you'll bring out your families and have a wonderful kind of time experiencing art at Art Barn.
Well, we appreciate you. It's Amy Navardakis, the Executive Director at Art Barn School of Art, 7th Annual Art Blitz, September 16th, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. and 695 North 400 East in Valparaiso. Amy, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Year and sharing.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Amy.
And a spotlight extra. Lakeshore Community Concerts, second concert of their 2024-25 season, will present the nationally acclaimed pianist, composer, entertainer, and speaker, Jason Lyle Black, with his lively concert, 100 Hits of the Stage and Screen, on Sunday, September 22nd at 2 p.m. at Highland High School's Monbeck Auditorium. Individual tickets are still available at lakeshoreconcerts.org or by calling 219-932-9795. 219-932-9795. Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by McCauley Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker.
Hi, this is Dorothy Graydon. I'm a contemporary artist in Northwest Indiana, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Timothy D. Lace and welcome back Diane Grams to Art on the Air. They are exhibiting Of Giants and Warriors, Tim Lace plus Diane Grams, featuring Diane's paintings and Tim's photographs. Diane is an award-winning artist and writer and is a recipient of the 2023-24 Individual Artist Grant from the Indiana Arts Commission for her work in fresco painting. She was recognized for her exhibited early work addressing gender inequality and censorship. She is also the author of 2 academic books and an award-winning academic article, and is married to Tim Lace. Tim is an exhibiting and published photographer. His images have appeared in Chicago Life magazine, The Chicago Reader, New City, Art in America, just to name a few. His work is produced through traditional photographic methods using a medium format camera and film and printed on gelatin silver paper. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Diane and Tim. It's very wonderful seeing both of you.
Thank you. Thank you, Esther. Thank you, Larry.
Well, we're so happy to have you on the show, especially together. But Tim, we're going to punch you up first. We had Diane on a previous episode, which you can find on our archive or at Lakeshore Public Media. But we want to know about your background story. Like I said, your origin story, how you got from where you were to where you're now. So tell us all about Tim.
Well, I was born in the far south side of Chicago in the Roseland area, born and raised there. As a kid, it was a middle class neighborhood. I mean, we had in the 60s, and I was a curious kid. So we had, you know, I always had an interest in motors and things and chemistry sets. And I was just a curious kid. And of course, we had 3 movie houses. So the cinema fascinated me. So I did acquire, we had a Polaroid camera, but I bought a rangefinder, an Argus. I don't know, Larry might know what those are. So I had my little 30, that was my foray into 35 millimeter photography. So I used that for family snapshots, things like that. Nothing serious, but I was able to at least develop with the chemistry knowledge. I was able to set up a little dark room and I was processing my film. So, I mean, that's kind of where the initial, the introduction to it and where I became, just the initial, I guess I could call it the passion for it, my love for it. As I got older, I still use the camera for snapshots, but I kind of grew out of the rangefinder. I had to get an SLR. And now through high school, I didn't do a whole lot other than just snapshots. I didn't get really serious with photography until just a little bit out of high school. And then I was working, of course, working in a factory, and I decided to take some classes at Prairie State College. And I started looking around, but I still enjoyed the darkroom. I enjoyed darkroom work. And so I was really moved. I was learning photography. I wanted to do fine photography, but in the darkroom, I love this darkroom magic. So I was attracted to the work of Jerry Ulsman. And I haven't shown a lot of that lately, but a lot of my early work is multiple image work where I would just go in and just, I would flop images, stack images, and do all sorts of kind of surrealistic dream kind of photographs and sandwich negatives. And I had a lot of fun with that. And that I have quite a body of work of that. But that was definitely my early work, and I kept it as my early work.
Well, Tim, I have a quick question before you go forward. So what were those? You keep mentioning the snapshots, but what were you taking photographs of? Did you have a particular focus, or was it just anything that captured your interest?
Just life's, well, yeah, you know, it's like anybody, life's events, family. You know, I didn't look at it as a commercial endeavor
I know, but sometimes people like landscapes and sometimes they sort of like a photojournalistic sort of bent.
No, I think just documenting, and I still look at photography as that, is capturing life's events, documenting life's events. You can freeze,
moment.
You can be in this moment, whether it's poetry or that special place, you can take this moment and revere it and, capture it and save it for later, share it. Of course, now share it, but share it with everybody.
Abundantly.
As I started looking at it seriously, I started looking at it as a visual vocabulary to say what I needed to say. The things involved, whether they were dreams, psychosis, motorcyclists, graffiti walls. And, it started to take shape, whether it be dunes, hang gliders, nudes. I mean, all these things, they just became this glom of surrealistic images. So as I looked at it a little bit more, now I, At that point, I was working at the Board of, I went to work at the Board of Trade of Chicago, and I wanted to go to take classes at the Art Institute. I got involved with, at that time, I was taking classes, and I got involved with the Generative Systems Program. And it was an approach to photography that wasn't a truly straight approach, but it was taking alternate methods and alternate processes, working with Codalith, which already I was, but just different processes, bookbinding, stitching. And that changed my vision, and I was a runner at the Board of Trade, and I was doing that for a while. But I wasn't really into the photo business. Now I was inspired. Now I became very inspired by the great ones, the Westons, the Ansel Adams. And I thought, gee, if I can make pictures like this, you know, but I needed a larger format camera, you know, so needed a bigger negative. But then I thought, you know, maybe I could move to California. I had this opportunity to move in the late 70s to California. And so I moved to San Francisco, and I was for work. That was my foray into the commercial world. I worked at a photo lab, commercial photo lab, but I found myself as the finisher, the mounter, and the exhibit producer. So, and it was a very fortunate thing, because the Image and Cunningham Trust was there. I got to meet Edward Weston's son, Brett Weston. I was working for people like Bill Owens, Richard Misrach, Harry Bowers. These were the heavies back in the early 80s, you know, or late 70s, when photography was getting recognized as an art form. So here I was, this young guy, barely 20 years old, and I'm producing and displaying these fine art exhibitions in museums. And it was great. It was fantastic. So, and as my vision and my work started to grow, I said, well, and I'm spending more time looking at Ansel Adams, looking at Edward Weston, and just going to these places, going to Yosemite, going to the Lake Tahoe, going to the coast, Big Sur coast. My attitudes, my tastes, my photography started to change. And I was still doing all kinds of, you know, event shooting, street photography. So but I had my black and white, I was doing my black and white work, and but I was still developing it. It just wasn't there. I needed to, you know, of course, work with the larger negative, work zone system. I looked into zone 6. So I moved back to Chicago. I was working in the photo labs. But I must add, I've had a 40-year career working in the lab the photo industry, which was photo labs, then it became digital and large format. And I was fortunate enough to kind of ride this wave, and to a point where we were recently, not until the recent past, that we were actually wrapping stadiums. Some of my last assignments were doing large format digital. And so it kept me going, but my particular work was progressing, and my black and white photography, I felt I was honing the craft, working with the zone system, traveling and getting more, compiling more images. So I guess we'll have to move up to, we can move up to about the year 2007. And Diane took the job at Tulane. It was kind of a zeitgeist year for us.
When did you meet during
Diane
all that?
Diane and I met in Chicago. I came back from San Francisco, and we had met in Chicago, and that was in the early 80s.
At Palace Photo.
I don't know if you know Mickey Palace. Mickey Palace was still there, and she was working at Palace Photo. I was working there. She was a nighttime printer. I don't want to say too much here. She was a printer at night, and I was the daytime finishing, the mounting, laminating, finishing guy. So we got to meet, and that was in 1982. So we've been together. We had a little time where I had to go back to San Francisco to take care of some business, but we've been together since 82.
You know, I have a question about, and then I want to move on to Diane so we don't run out of time. Yeah. The move from, you're using these layered images you talked about and working in the darkroom, the transition to digital and embracing like Photoshop, or did you do that? Or how did you make that transition? Or do you still prefer working with film in darkroom? Or do you find that, like, as I do, Photoshop is a darkroom?
No, I use Photoshop I use Photoshop to print the images, but I don't use a lot of Photoshop to, I've kind of left that whole multiple image thing alone. Occasionally I will go in and, do some, a few Photoshop tricks, but I just basically use Photoshop to, my camera has a program where I can print from, but I use Photoshop just as a printing platform that works through the printer. Might do a little bit of correction, some retouch. I'll use Photoshop for retouching for some correction and a slight enhancement. Although my color stuff, I don't enhance a lot, but it is always nice to pump a little bit extra color in. Of course, with brightness, contrast, that I'll use those. I'll use those tools. But to answer your question, Larry, no, I haven't gone. I've left the whole crazy multiple image thing alone, and I like those things. In fact, I'm planning on showing them or doing something with them into a book, or basically 2007. And Diane was at Tulane, and my second trip down to New Orleans, I think I helped her move down there, but I stayed up here. I followed the music, and I heard the music. I followed the music into the back streets, and I found the second line parades, and I found the Indians. And so that's where I started. I said, well, this is great. I can just take pictures of these. And we'll talk about it later. So that's how that led up to the show that's going to be at Chesterton.
Diane, interview, by the way, if you want to catch it, is on September 17th of 2021. You can get on Lakeshore. Diane, give us a brief synopsis of that. They can go back and listen to your whole story before, and then we'll get into the exhibit.
Well, I wanted to say that the exhibit is titled Of Giants and Warriors, and that was based off of my show last year at Lobuznik, was where I kind of, when I was, just to give you the backstory, I first learned fresco in 1980 at Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture. I was at Indiana University Bloomington and getting my bachelor's degree in painting. And I was selected as one of two artists from Indiana to go to Skowhegan. And it was two fresco artists who started that school, but it is kind of a very groovy school and not everybody that goes there does fresco, but I really wanted to learn fresco. And it's a summer program. And so I was invited back in 2021, right before I was on your show, for this alumni summer because of COVID. And I was already doing frescoes again. And I did a lot of frescoes in 2021 before I went there and afterwards. And then I applied for an Indiana Arts Commission grant to buy more materials and build this temporary wall to do some mock-ups for some large murals, because you have to find a place to do fresco. And I do a lot of portable ones, but then my hope is to be doing permanent commissions with large scale frescoes. And so that's what I've been doing this whole past year. And the show is called Of Giants and Warriors, because in learning, the Indians are a lot about, they're Black people for the most part, are biracial Black and Indian people who make these suits. They bead these suits for Mardi Gras. And I was learning fresco, and I just felt like I am standing on the shoulders of giants. And so that's really where the title came from, Of Giants and Warriors. And so my work also has a feminist edge to it. And so I do have one piece that actually has the names of a lot of the women who I felt strongly affected me. And I didn't really like the word God, because sometimes women are left out of that. So I liked the word giants better. So that's how I kind of glommed onto the idea of giants and warriors. And my paintings, I try to link these ideas of like some of the early stuff was a girl rolling backwards in various locations throughout the world, including Pompeii, which is in the Villa of Mysteries. And that's all about, and I used some AI to help me think through some of my ideas about the press release. And it just wrote the most beautiful thing about the girl rolling backwards, as about referring to the rolling backwards of women's rights and how it's etched in stone, to have these frescoes. So it really is about linking the ancient with the modern and some of these political concerns. But I have some things that are really about, we spent some time traveling throughout Indiana taking photographs of the limestone quarries. And a lot of my current work has the limestone quarries in it, because fresco is made from baked limestone that then becomes this lime putty, and it becomes this beautiful plastic substance that will hold pigment and crystallize into these images and last literally forever.
on the show, but also your work, since you're kind of from two different mediums, do you ever collaborate on a project? I mean, you're collaborating obviously on this exhibit, but do you ever collaborate on a project to have Tim bring you something that you're going to use or vice versa?
Well, we have, and we do collaborate on literally everything we do. I mean, yes, we actually have a few pieces that we've shown together where I've done some drawings and he's done photographs of the same place. In fact, some of the photographs that he's shown, I have paintings of. And we're hoping that next year we will be able to do a show that includes some of his photographs of Indiana landscapes and my paintings that are the frescoes of these same places, the abandoned limestone quarries in France Park and in southern Indiana. They're not abandoned. They still are carving out lime. But so we're hoping to do that. But he does all of my woodworking. He cuts builds the back frames, the substrates for the frescoes. He built this wall for me. And then he's got the pictures laid. I introduced him to a lot of the Indians because I was studying them. I was a cultural sociologist on the faculty at Tulane. And so I know a lot of these people that he's photographed. And so it was kind of like I introduced him to it, and I was taking more sociological photos and videos, and he was doing these rich artistic photos. And so they're laying all over the place, and I help him go through and choose. He goes, which one here, which one there? So there's a lot of comments back and forth. And then the text that we're going to have some text on the wall that helps to both explain some of the historical and sociological stuff that's going on in his photos, because I think Midwesterners don't understand what this is about. I mean, these are a lot of Black men were doing this beadwork. In fact, they think women can't do beadwork, but they do patches where they're all year long, they're stitching pictures of, and I'll let Tim talk about that, but they're patches that are then assembled into these suits. And so did you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah. Initially, I was hoping to have her take photo documentation for some of her papers, some of her lectures, and her books, which I've provided some of the graphic sources for. But then I thought, as I was photographing these Indians, I thought to myself, I said, there's a story here. And what story can I tell that no one else has told? And Diane mentioned too, we developed this intimacy with the Indians. So I could be out there. They only parade two times a year. The city has restrictions on them parading. So they convene two times a year. So I would use my flash to bring, because you never know what kind of lighting situation. So I wanted to get a sort of an intimate. And I like the three-quarter shot and with the flash just to show the color. But Diane mentioned the beadwork, the patchwork. So they tell stories through their beadwork, and it's basically the struggle that the African Americans have had with the Native Americans and how they've come together. And this is what the Mardi Gras Indians are celebrating. And the stories are told in their beadwork and their patchwork. So I'm highlighting a lot of that in the show. So It's the craft of it, the intricacy of it, the colors, you know, so it lent itself very, very much to digital, you know, with the flash on the camera, digital, and then crank these things up and just have really nice.
Yeah, they're incredibly vibrant.
They really do move.
Yeah.
There have been movies and other photographers have done it, but I felt like mine are a little special. I initially showed them to, well, Hannah saw them. I initially showed them to Dan Breen from Panoply. They all sort of sat in my hard drive and on a shelf, and I really didn't. I was printing them occasionally, but I didn't. I saw it as a show, but I really didn't throw it all together. But then Hannah said, "You know, you kind of got something here. Let's do something." So that's how it all came to fruition.
So one of the stories that I learned when, and this is in my article that I won an award for, was just the fact that, you know, a lot of the Native Americans were moved from wherever they were, and they did go through New Orleans, and some of the people I interviewed were Choctaw, and when they were being moved to Oklahoma, they just said, no, we're not Indian, we're Black. And in their words, it says, no, we're Black, we're staying. And so this whole thing of like the Black and the Indians together really represents freedom for them in this particular culture. It's a way to come out and just be something absolutely spectacular. And I just loved it. But then when Tim was taking these pictures, he got so much stuff that I never got in my, with my, I was shooting video with a camcorder mostly, and I would take pictures, but I wasn't getting the detail that he is. So they're very beautiful in detail.
So tell us the process of how you talked briefly about showing your work to Hannah, then Diane, you also, and how that came together as an exhibit.
Well, we proposed it to her when right when she became the director, and we wanted to both do a show. And so he's going to be in the front part of the gallery at the center, and I'm going to be in the back. And it's really kind of two separate exhibits, but we're saying because we both worked on each other's exhibit, it is a collaboration. But mine is really, I'm really looking at the place of fresco in Indiana, because what I loved about when I first learned fresco, I thought I had to get all the stuff from Italy. And then I learned actually maybe about 15 years ago that I could just get lime from Indiana. And so that's really what it's really about, a love letter to Indiana. My frescoes are this beauty of the state and the limestone and this stone that, you know, makes these government buildings. I mean, a lot of the Washington Monument and the Empire State Building is made from Indiana limestone. And the fresco is, you know, this burnt limestone inside, which became a very beautiful plaster.
In our last few moments here, we're going to give you a chance to talk about the dates of the exhibit, everything in opening celebration.
So the show, the reception is September 20th from 4 to 7. The show will be up from September 6th through October 30th. It's a two-month show. But the reception is September 20th, 4 to 7. We have an artist talk, which we're both going to walk you through our various exhibitions on September 28th, which is a Saturday, from noon to 1. And then on October 19th at noon, I'm going to be doing a fresco demonstration to show that, you know, this beautiful putty is so different from what you can buy at today. You know, the mud that's used on drywall, it's nothing like the material that I use for fresco. So I'm going to do a little demonstration. And all these are free. And so we really would hope that people would come out to the Chesterton Arts Center.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. That Tim Lace, photography and paintings by Diane Graham of Giants and Warriors. It'll run September 6th through October 30th with a reception on the third Friday, September 20th at 4 to 7 p.m. Tim and Diane, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air and sharing.
Yeah, thank you. It was so interesting.
Thank you for having me again and us together. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
This is Hannah Hammond-Hagman of Chesterton Art Center, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM and WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Michael Shane to Art on the Air. Michael is an artist experienced in many types of art media, but is well-known and award-winning for his detailed, large-format, black-and-white scratchboard fine art pieces. Scratchboard is considered a form of etching or direct engraving. Michael's pieces explore themes that are deeply ingrained in the cultural fabric of African-American experience. From the beautiful to the painful, his work tells stories one scratch at a time. Michael's work is currently being exhibited at the fabulous Gallery Guichard in Chicago's Bronzeville neighborhood and is titled Scratching the Surface. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Michael. It's very wonderful meeting you.
Hello. Nice to meet you. Thank you for having me.
Well, Michael, like we always want it with our guests, is we'd like to know their, what I call their origin story, all the way back to where you were born, where you grew up, early art influences, if there were any, and all the way how you got. I would like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Michael.
Okay, it's the how it started versus how it's going aspect. Yep. Well, I'm originally from Southern Ohio, Dayton, Ohio, born and raised, and was always a highly creative little kid. My mother figured that out when I was small, very small, and to keep me occupied, she always carried around a little bag of brown paper bag of crayons and drawing paper. Whether it was in church, in the cart at the grocery store, she would give it to me, and that would just occupy me for hours. So she knew how to occupy me and control me, the creative mind and brain that I had as a child, by just giving me the tools to just go create and make stories. And she would challenge me, draw me this, draw mommy that, and that became a thing. And then I started doing it for other family members. And I thought it was one of those things that everybody did. I thought every other child could draw until I hit like kindergarten. And I remember having a kindergarten teacher who still to this day was Morgan Freeman in my mind. He looked like him. He sounded like him. I cannot think of his name, but he was like this really cool figure. And I remember sitting in his class one day in kindergarten. And I remember the first day at art class, he challenged all the kids. He's like, I just want to know about you. Draw your favorite thing. And at the time, I was really into Godzilla. So I drew this really cool picture of Godzilla. And I remember him walking over, turning the paper around and looking at it, just saying, hey, can I speak to your mother when she picks you up from school? And I thought, oh, maybe I did something wrong. Maybe Godzilla's not allowed at the school. Maybe I don't know what's going on. And I remember when she picked me up from school, she came in and he said he's doing things that other kids in the class aren't. Maybe you should get him into classes. Maybe you should expose him to more things. And that was the first time I realized, like, oh, wow, I can kind of do things some other kids can't do. And that, to me, that kind of felt like a superpower, right?
Yeah, it is. It is a superpower.
Yeah, but that was it. And from that point, I just started consuming art. She started exposing me to art. If she worked retail at a couple retail centers in Dayton, Ohio, and anytime they got an artwork, you know, in the store, she would have me come in and take a look at it. And it was always like some still life of, you know, fruit and glasses or something. But she knew it would occupy me. I would sit there and stare at it and just analyze the shadows and the colors as a kid for the longest time. So that was my introduction to art as a child. And then it was a point in growing up where we, for a brief period of time, we were unhoused. And we ended up staying in a couple of different places. One of them, I always have a love for Dunkin' Donuts because we had a friend that managed Dunkin' Donuts 24 hours and we would spend the night there at the Dunkin' Donuts. And the same thing, they would give me something to draw and occupy my mind so I wouldn't focus on what was happening. But we also had she had a friend who managed a little motel. And every now and then we sneak in and have a room for the night at the motel. And in those rooms, there were Norman Rockwell paintings in every room, different room. And those just, the storytelling in them, I would just fill out the story in my brain, my mind, and see what was going on. And there was just something about them that was captivating. So Norman Rockwell was probably my very biggest first influence. And then after that, I think like a lot of us, I think my next big exposure was watching TV. I remember sitting there in front of the TV and watching Good Times and the Ernie Barnes paintings that would come on and just being captivated by the Sugar Shack painting of the Ernie Barnes did on those shows and trying to replicate it and draw that and show my mother and doing variations of it. So those were the first two early experiences with art and being exposed to it and trying to consume it and my mother helping frame it for me and exposing me to it. So that became a thing. But as I got older, it really wasn't that cool, right? You get into your teen years and you get a little older and art came so easy to me. I always had the creative mind was still there, but the art was so easy that it didn't seem like a viable thing to do anymore. I would do the graffiti on the side a little. Back, it was the 90s, everybody airbrushed on t-shirts, so I would do that for people. And it was just a hobby. And my dream was I'm going to play football. Like, you're a young man, you grew up in Ohio, everybody wants to play football. And that was like, okay, to get out of this neighborhood, this community, and to have a life, I need to get out of where I'm at right now. And I thought sports and football would be the thing because I never seen a working artist before. I'd never seen a working creative person before. Everybody was military. I worked at a factory, or they play sports to get out of where we were to get to other places. So I never thought about art as a venue to sing, as like a passport to seeing the world and exploring the world. I ended up tearing my knee up my senior year, and the football dreams went out the window. I did not have the money to walk on and pay for college, and all the scholarships, they weren't available anymore. So I was going into my senior year in high school. I hit a little bit of depression and kind of started to rebel because it was, to me, you know, everything's dramatic when you're 17, 18. I thought the world was ending.
Sure, you had a plan, and it shifted dramatically.
It was just plan A. That's all I thought about. There were no plan Bs. So it started doing really dumb things. My mother, bless her heart, she tried her best, but I was still doing some really dumb things in school. And I remember I had an art teacher, two art teachers, Miss Staley and Miss Francis. And I remember Miss Francis came to me one day and said, hey, can I borrow you for a Saturday? I need your mother to sign this permission slip. Yeah, sure, whatever. What's it for? I thought it would be some volunteer work or something. So my mother signed the permission slip. I showed up at the school Saturday morning, and I thought there'd be like a group of us, because every now and then they have people clean up the school and things. And it was always a way to hang out with friends on the weekend. But I showed up, and it was just her and I. And she's jumped in the car. I jumped in the car, and she took me to Columbus, Ohio, to the College of CCAD, the art school there.
Wow.
And I remember walking on that campus, and I was just blown away. We did a tour, and I got to see fashion design, interior design, package design, animation, special effects, illustration, this new thing, Photoshop and digital illustration coming out. And it was just mind-blowing. I remember she said, you have a talent, you have a gift. It comes so easy to you that you're overlooking it, and you've only thought of one way of, you know, getting out of here. She was like, everything that you see, everything that you touch, an artist has had their hand on it somewhere in the process. You just have to choose which one you want to be. Which one appeals to you. And that changed everything. That changed. I knew what I wanted. That fire was back. That energy was back. And I started seeing the world like I did as a little kid. Everything was colors mm-hmm. and shapes and balance and motion. And my mind just opened back up again to the beauty of the world. So Miss Francis, Miss Staley, I still keep in touch with Miss Staley. And I thank her every day for the exposure. But that changed everything.
And that's gorgeous.
What a gift she gave you. That was fantastic.
She did. Amazing.
So while you were in school, it sounds like you were very sports-minded, but were there art classes? And were you exploring different forms of art within like high school?
I was. It was interesting in high school. Now that I look back at it, Miss Francis and Miss Staley always had a slight guiding hand. Like this invisible hand ushering me through art classes. I'd taken all the art classes, and I was so proficient in them that they skipped me from art one to art two. Then I just completed all those assignments in art three. So Miss Francis, Miss Staley started creating extra curriculums. They created special art classes for me and another gentleman who now works for Marvel Comics, another guy I went to school with. And it was pretty much, she helped us build a portfolio. We didn't realize that she was helping us build portfolios to go to school. But she exposed us to oil paintings, charcoals. We really got into art history. I remember she had Bing Davis come in and speak to us at one point. And it was so subtle, the way they were doing it. We didn't know they were putting us down this path and exposing us to things with the hope that it would pay off. And it did. But in school, I was the creative kid drawing on the desk. I remember I had a couple other teachers who would allow me to get extra credit in classes like algebra, and if I would just draw pictures for extra credit. So
yeah,
it was a thing. So I always had like these teachers who would do things to kind of encourage me to do more art. Even the football coaches would have me designing things for them, t-shirts and plaques and banners. So it's funny.
That's good training.
Yeah, it was great training. And for a while there, I thought, well, I did this myself. This is my thing. And I figured this out. And as I got older, it was like, no, there were all these invisible guiding hands purposefully moving and maneuvering me through this system and exposing me to things and encouraging me without being heavy-handed. Because as a teenager, you know, if somebody with authority says, you need to be doing this, you're going to go in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
So that was it. That was high school. That was the exposure in high school. And that changed the future path for me in art.
Well, then take us through college. I don't know if you went there, but what were your choices that you did? And what areas did you pursue before we get to your current practice?
College was interesting. Finishing up high school, I remember I had a guidance counselor that brought me into his office and just wanted to have a conversation with me, you know, the seniors, and hey, what's everybody's plans, you know, and we're working with the yearbooks, and these people, you know, you have to put in there what your future plans are, where you're going to school. And I remember telling him, I'm going to go to the Columbus College of Art and Design. I'm going to be an artist. And he said, are you sure you want to do that? It's like, you're good with your hands, maybe carpentry, maybe at one of the factories. And it just deflated me. It just like, it's like, is that a viable career? And it deflated me. I remember going back, telling one of the art teachers, and she was furious. And she's like, remember what you saw in Columbus. Remember what you saw out there, all these working people. So that inspired me again. And we started looking at different art schools. And my thing was, I always wanted to get as far away from home as possible. I just wanted to see the world, right? But I ended up going an hour up the street to the Columbus College of Art and Design. And there I was, you know, the first year they exposed to everything. You can't pick a major. You're exposed to everything. Because everybody that goes in there, they want to be an illustrator or a comic book artist. And they're like, no, no, no. Check out fashion design. Check out building furniture. Check out all these things. You never know what you'll have a passion for until you're exposed to it. And I was doing that and really started liking fine art, oil paintings and watercolors. And it was calling to me. But I started to figure out myself and how the best way for me to learn and receive information. And that school was it was just too big. You're in art class and there's 50, 60 students and you get 20 seconds with the professor. And it just wasn't, I just wasn't clicking there. So I started researching around and had a conversation with a gentleman. I was part of the Black Student Union on campus and we had a speaker come in. He designed textiles for, at the time, I think, is it the JCPenney's or Sears, an African-American designer. And I remember we had a conversation afterwards and he just happened to mention, he was like, you know, some of the best schools that I've seen in the country that produce the best talent aren't the big factory schools. And it's not a knock on CCAD or even CCS, which is here, a big school here in Detroit. But he was like, everybody learns differently. He was like, and I was telling him some of my issues and he explained like, maybe you need smaller classes. You need more one-on-one and, you know, hands-on learning. So I started looking for smaller art schools and I found a great one, which was even closer to home. Even though I wanted to go see the world, I found one that's even closer to home. It was the Modern School of Design in Kettering, Ohio. It was set up much like an ad agency, really. It was an intense year-round two-year school. And I remember you could only miss like 3 days of class or you failed the entire year. And it was very pressure oriented, but it was hands-on and they really, really worked with you and taught you everything about design and illustration that they could pack in the 2 years. And that was my exposure. And that's also my first exposure to scratchboard. Was there classes? Yeah, not a good experience.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media 89.1 FM on WVLP 103.1 FM.
So you did not get the elementary school experience of scratchboard.
I did not. That was interesting because I remember it was a class. Paul Behrens was the instructor, a great instructor. He was an illustrator for the U.S. Army during the Korean War. Great guy. And his thing was, I'm going to challenge people. My thing is to challenge and expose you guys to everything that he knew and to get out of your comfort zone. So we did these paintings, gouache and watercolor, I love watercolors. I love the unexpectedness, the bright colors, just the motion of it, right? Kind of my thing. And then one day in class, he brought in scratchboard. And a lot of people were experienced with it. Like, oh, I did that in, you know, elementary school. And, well, what is this? I have no idea what this is. And I remember this particular project, we just had to pick, we had to do a piece of an animal and turn it in. We had 3 weeks to turn this project in. And I just thought my brain was like, oh, this is like drawing in black and white, like negative. It's just the reverse. I'll knock this out easily and go have fun. And I remember spending 2 days on this piece. It was a bulldog and did it and thought, eh, that's good enough. And I found it so challenging. It was like annoying me and frustrating me and everything had come so easy. I finally was exposed to a medium that was challenging me. I couldn't quite
hurting your brain.
It was hurting my brain because black and white art up until that point, you create shape and form by putting shadows down. And this was more like, at the time I didn't realize it, this was more like photography. You create shape and form by where you want to put the light. So you have to remove the blackness from that area where you want the light as opposed to putting darkness down to create shadows to create the form. And my brain just could not flip that switch. And I remember like thinking, oh, this is good enough. And I just turned it in. And he's like, oh, that's nice. Fail. You got now you have 2 weeks to redo it and turn it in. Like, oh my God, this is one of the last projects in for the entire school year as well. It's like, oh my God, I turned it in. I did another one, turned it in. He was like, okay. Fell. It was like, this is not, and I just could not figure it out. It became so frustrating. So I said, okay, let me sit down and really focus and just, again, dissect. Look at this. Look at pieces and examples that are out there and figure out what I'm doing wrong. And that's when the switch flipped to say, you know what? This is about light. This isn't about just line drawing. And this is about figuring out where you want to put the light. This is almost like sculpture. This is, you take away the things that you don't need to let the light come through. And once that happened, I hurried up and finished and did that little bulldog piece, turned it in. And he said, this is passing. It's good enough. Get it out of my face. I never want to see scratch board again. And that was it. I hated that. I hated scratch board. Never wanted to see it again in my life. Then about 10 years later, 10 years later, you know, working in the professional field, working in, as an art director in ad agencies, and, you know, you hit a point to where, you know, if you're creative, you still have to have a creative outlet when you're working in the professional world, because you're doing a lot of creative and thinking for other people. And I got a little frustrated, and I don't sing. I can't play in a band when everybody else was doing, but it's like, let me go back to my art roots, my fine art roots, start doing that for myself. And I said, what can I do? If I'm going to do it, let me do something that's going to challenge me again. I haven't done sculpture. I haven't done charcoal. I haven't done pastel. And my wife pulled that little bulldog out of the closet and said, hey, this is my favorite piece you ever did. And I was like, oh, my God, I hate that. Where did it? I didn't know you had that. Get it away. But then I was like, you know what? Let me see what's out there. And I found these amazing scratchboard artists online. Kathy Sheeter, Diana Lee. They're doing these
amazing. Sally Maxwell.
Sally Maxwell, exactly. They're doing some amazing work out there, especially at the wildlife and nature artwork. And I started studying, and there was an International Scratchboard Society meeting in Indianapolis. And I made my way over there and got to get behind the scenes and hang out with all of them in these workshops and learned so much. And I just, again, the brain, right, just opened up. It was a whole new world, and I've been hooked ever since. And it's also forced me to focus and concentrate and really think about what I'm doing. So it's very therapeutic, and I've just been in love with it ever since.
It is. It really, like, these things that really challenge our brain and our talents are the most healing for us and the most exciting. So can we now, I would like to touch on the current exhibit and your current work, which is not, it's portrait, more portraits, but very deep portraits. And I just want to say they're extremely moving, Michael, and I see them as we carry our ancestral heritage with us. And sometimes it's on the surface, but sometimes it's hidden even from ourselves, and that we are all a combination of light and shadow that shift. And you see that in this particular body of work so deeply. Can you explain what brought you to that particular body of work?
That particular body of work, it was funny. I really started out doing just beautiful portraiture work. And it was, they were just pretty pictures. But around 2020, even before 2020, living in Detroit, the Flint water crisis happened. And it was like, I have something to say about this, but I'm not, you know, a journalist. I'm not a bloviator. I'm not that person. But it's like, I'm creative. I need to say something. And it's like, I need to say it through my art. And at that point, I'd never really done any sort of social justice or art that communicated things that were happening in the community. They were just figurative, beautiful, figurative pieces of art. And then, you know, started to realize, like, wait, there's something about scratchboard that really lines up with the tapestry of life. We're all made up, all of our lives are made up of these little moments of light that we scratch against the darkness to create these pictures that we want of our, how we want our lives to be. And from that point, it was like, let me, these things that I feel that I can't articulate verbally, let me start telling these stories and communicating this through the artwork. So the first couple of pieces I did were for the Flint water crisis. So did some for the Flint water crisis. Then 2020, George Floyd, I did some pieces that speak to some of those situations. So this, a lot of the pieces in that collection, Scratching the Surface, are social justice pieces. But they first initially catch your attention because they look like just beautiful pieces of portraiture.
They're dramatic.
I've always loved black and white photography, so they wanted to have that feel. But as you look closer, you see little details. You'll see on one of the pieces, the woman who looks like she's modeling jewelry, like bracelets and earrings. You'll see that the jewelry is made up of little pieces of colored plastic. Those colored pieces of plastic are made out of water bottles that are recovered from the Flint water replenishing stations from the National Guard, kind of know, fast talked our way and getting our hands on some of those and created jewelry out of it. And then there's a faucet on that piece where it feels, I've used resin to make it feel like water is pouring over her, because that particular model for that piece was a working model out of Flint, and they were living out of water bottles, but she had to get up every day and make herself look good, feel good, to put this face on for the clients that she was working with. And it's that, it's the beauty, there's tragedy and beauty that are intertwined. You just got to look a little deeper. And it's a thing with me now that I feel like the world is becoming so polarized. It's either black or it's white. It's this tribalism thing. And I don't think that's how life is. I think everybody, it's the picture is made up of black and white, and they overlap, and how you shape them and form them create the picture.
Unfortunately, Michael, we are out of time. Very briefly talks about how the exhibit's running and how we can find you online in a real short moment here.
Yep. To find me online, the best way to find the latest work right now is through my Instagram, Michael Shane Art, M-Y-C-H-A-E-L, Shane Art on Instagram. I do have a website, but it has not been updated with the work that's at the Gallery Guichard right now. And that's where the current body of work is at, in Chicago in the Bronzeville District at Gallery Guichard, if you want to see Scratching the Surface.
Thank you so much. That's Michael Shane, and you can see his work at Gallery Guichard. Thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air and sharing your wonderful art journey.
Yeah, thank you for this really beautiful conversation.
No problem. I thank you. I appreciate you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show